Exercise 10-10. Express regret about what happened to your company, like this. You hear?
The government didn't help.
You say?
If only the government had helped.
You hear the correct answer.
If only the government had helped.
Now you try.
The government didn't help.
If only the government had helped.
The company went into liquidation.
If only the company hadn't gone into liquidation.
The bank didn't lend them more money.
If only the bank had lent them more money.
500 people lost their jobs.
If only 500 people hadn't lost their jobs.
The company went bust.
If only the company hadn't gone bust.
The company was undercapitalized.
If only the company hadn't been undercapitalized.
The company didn't develop new products.
If only the company had developed new products.
The company didn't make workers redundant.
If only the company had made workers redundant.
The management didn't accept new ideas.
If only the management had accepted new ideas.
The company wasn't saved.
If only the company had been saved.
Exercise 10-11. The International Money Programme.
In the days of the British Empire, the Crown agents provided the colonies with whatever they required: armchairs or zoologists, postage stamps or railways. But since the end of empire, the agent's future has repeatedly been threatened, and now the British government has decided that the agents should be reorganized and then privatized, that is, sold off to new private owners. The announcement marked the end of a debate that flared up last year when the agents lost a contract to manage the £3.5 billion investment portfolio of Brunei, the oil-rich and newly independent sultanate in Southeast Asia. Paul Maidment, world business editor of The Economist magazine, has been looking into the Crown agents' troubles.
The loss cost the agents some £4 million a year in earnings, enough to push it back into the red. And that, in turn, even worse from the agents' point of view, meant that the agents could not meet the requirements the government made after it rescued the agents in 1980, that the agents should be financially viable again by 1984. The government had taken over the agents after spending 5 years and £175 million trying to keep it afloat. In 1975, it had become technically insolvent. It had speculated in property in London and Australia in the late 1960s and lost more than £200 million when the market crashed in 1974. The subsequent official inquiry revealed a pitiful tale of incompetence and inexperience, as the agents had attempted to change their traditional but diminishing role of procuring supplies for colonies into one of providing for new developing nations other services, particularly financial ones such as investment management. The loss of the core of this new business, the Brunei contract, strengthened the argument of the Treasury and some Conservative members of Parliament who wanted the agents scrapped or sold off immediately. But some three-quarters of the £200 million worth of goods the agent still buys each year for foreign governments is British-made, and the Foreign Office, the Ministries of Overseas Development and Trade, and British industrialists with overseas interests all argued that much of this business came because the agents was a government agency, because foreign governments found it easier to deal with a public corporation than with a private company. This view prevailed after the London Merchant Bank, Morgan Grenfell, retained by the government to advise on the future of the agents, gave its backing to a reorganisation plan drawn up by the new senior Crown agent, Mr. Peter Graham, who is also a deputy chairman of the Standard Chartered Bank. Mr. Graham is aiming for a slimmer and leaner Crown agents. He is cutting the staff by a third to 900 and trying to give a sharper commercial edge to those who remain, to deal with its procurement, project management and investment services. He plans to sell the agent's imposing central London headquarters, to cut in half a capital debt of nearly £20 million, and for its part, the government will write off the interest payments it is owed on that debt, some £2 million a year. When privatisation comes in 1986, it is likely to be a gradual process, though. Mr. Graham first sees a group of big City of London investing institutions taking a small stake, and then the staff taking up to 20% through a management buyout. That would still leave the government holding about 50% for some time, so as not to risk losing the custom of overseas governments, which value the public sector reputation of the agents, and so keep the agents as an effective channel for overseas orders for British companies, the reason it has stayed alive. This is Paul Maidment for the BBC's International Money Programme.
Unit 11. Stocks, shares and investment. Exercise 11.7. Say the negative of the words you hear like this. You hear.
Agree.
You say.
Disagree.
You hear the correct answer.
Disagree.
Now you try. 2.
Approval.
Disapproval.
3.
Associated.
Disassociated.
4.
Available.
Unavailable.
5.
Calculation.
Miscalculation.
6.
Climax.
Anticlimax.
7.
Competence.
Incompetence.
8.
Diluted.
Undiluted.
9.
Friendly.
Unfriendly.
10.
Fortune.
Misfortune.
11.
Paid.
Unpaid.
12.
Signed.
Unsigned.
13.
Sobriety.
In sobriety.
14.
Sufficient.
Insufficient.
15.
Surpassed.
Unsurpassed.
16.
Usual.
Unusual.
17.
Voting.
Non-voting.
18.
Welcome.
Unwelcome.
Exercise 11.8. The International Money Programme.
In what has been described as the share sale of the century, British Telecom, who run the United Kingdom telephone system, is being put onto the open market at the end of November. British Telecom's current market value is something over £7 billion, and the British government are offering 51% of the shares to the public, an offer which is expected to bring in some £3.5 billion into the Exchequer's coffers. Thus, the government will retain 49% of the privatised company. It's the largest single block of shares ever offered on the open market, and it's being offered internationally. Dominic Harrod, the BBC's economics editor, told Mike Popham why the British government had decided to privatise British Telecom.
I think the main reason is the general feeling, the philosophy that this government has, that things are better run by private individuals and by private concerns than by bureaucracies under the sway of government. And the reason is that, in fact, the telephone system might be more efficiently run if it was run outside the state system. Of course, there are those who argue against that, that in certain areas in a country like Britain, in rural areas, where there may be not very many telephones and they may be public telephone boxes rather than private telephones in houses, those will cost a lot of money, and a commercial enterprise would not wish to run them, and therefore some of the social service of the telephone system might get neglected if it was in private hands. The technique that the government is using to get round this particular corner is to have a license, to license the future company, and in that license there are obligations on things they have to do, whether they like it or not.
Now the next question is, will it be a good investment?
This entirely depends, in the long run, on whether they make a success of it. The shares are offered at a price which is intended to attract investors of the institutional kind, but also they're intended to be attractive to telephone users. They're making a very big pitch towards the actual user. Now, that, of course, only applies in Britain itself. It would not apply to the international segment, which is going to be sold in Tokyo and in New York and so on, where there is another inducement, and that is, in fact, the offer of one share for every 10 bought. So long as the person who buys the shares in the first place holds them for 3 years, they get a 1-for-10 issue free. But the success of the investment will depend on whether the company can operate successfully. They are not going to be permitted to put up their prices to domestic users of the telephone by as much as the rise in the cost of living. They are going to be kept under a ceiling by the terms of the license, which is 3% less than the rise in the cost of living each year. And that means that any increase in their profits, which are already considerable, but any increase will have to come from greater efficiency. So you really have to take, in the long run, a view as to whether you think an inefficient bureaucracy running the telephone system will be improved or will not, because it's got to be done by efficiency. They can't do it by just putting the price up.
Exercise 11.11. You are a stockbroker and financial advisor in Britain. A client has come to talk to you about British Telecom shares. Listen to his questions, press the pause button between each thing he says, and give a suitable response.
Good morning. Fine, thanks. And you? Well, I'm quite interested in British Telecom shares, and I wondered if you could tell me a bit more about them. Firstly, what's this about a bonus share issue? I see. And I've also heard something about bill vouchers instead of bonus shares. What's that about? And are there any conditions? And do I have to pay for them all at once? And is it a good investment, do you think? Well, it certainly sounds interesting at any rate. Perhaps I'll go away and think about it a bit more. Thanks for your help.
Unit 12. Exchange and Interest Rates. Exercises 12.3 and 12.4. The International Money Program.
First, the US dollar. A strong currency is generally seen as a sign of economic health. But if one country's currency dominates all others, it can also cause problems for that country as well as for its trading partners. The United States dollar has been in this position of strength for nearly 3 years. From San Francisco, Rod Sharp reports on the consequences.
Summer may have faded into memory, but there's no doubt that Americans with the travel bug are still looking for places to go. How about spending Christmas in Mexico? From California, for example, travel agents are offering air tickets and an excellent hotel room for two in unspoiled beach resorts far south of all the tourists in Tijuana. And the price for 7 nights? Just over $500. With the emphasis on dollars. The Mexican peso's nosedive against the mighty greenback in the last 4 years has been fueled by successive devaluations, which have reduced its value by a massive factor of 7. The havoc which the dollar has wreaked in better managed economies has been felt on the 7 financial seas of the world. In 1979, you could buy a dollar with 4 French francs. It takes nearly 8 to do it now. The British pound and the Swiss franc have lost about a quarter of their value in the same time. The bad consequences are reflected in higher raw materials costs when those costs are passed on in dollars. And the main one, of course, is oil. So despite March's $5 cut in OPEC's price for a barrel, many countries are paying more than ever. The consequences for third world countries carrying a large enough burden of debt anyway are quite clear. The higher the dollar, the more international debt, the more pressure on the International Monetary Fund, while a significant number of powerful American politicians still continue to expect the president to contribute less to this all-important international lifeboat. On the other hand, it's a two-way traffic for exporters, especially the Japanese, A car that sold for 10,000 yen in San Francisco a couple of years ago is going for the currency equivalent of 8,000 yen today. In 1979, the dollar was at an all-time low against the other major currencies. International money men came down like a ton of bricks on Federal Reserve Board Chairman Paul Volcker and told him to do something, anything, to stop their currencies from appreciating. It was a great success. In no time at all, American interest rates, which had never been anything special, were so attractive that money was pouring in from all over the place. Foreign buyers scrambled to buy dollars, to buy high-yielding U.S. government bonds, and the rest is what we have now. Many economists are supposed to feel the dollar is 25% overvalued. American companies, sensitive as never before to the export market, are finding slack demand for their overpriced products. Does it mean fewer jobs in American industry? Certainly doesn't mean any more. The result is a record deficit in the American balance of trade, an estimated $70 billion this year and racing up to the extraordinary prospect of $100 billion, perhaps next year. The government's own borrowings at home and abroad could reach $200 billion next year, according to the latest public testimony by the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, creating higher interest rates, which will attract more foreign money and make the dollar even stronger. Not even a world of crisis can halt the dollar's rapid rise. In a week of carnage from Lebanon to the Caribbean, the price of gold, the old standby in a banker's panic, fell to a 14-month low as dealers sought security in dollars. But Uncle Sam can do no wrong. He has to put it right. The pressure is now firmly on the Reagan administration from outside the country and within to do the unthinkable and raise taxes to control borrowing and consequently the runaway growth of the dollar before it is too late and the domestic political considerations of an election year blind the president to the interests of a wider world. For the International Money Program, this is Rod Sharp in San Francisco.